Law and Grace, Chapter 10, The Feasts of the Lord, The Spiritual Basis of the Sacred Calendar. Israel were no ordinary people, and the law saw to it that they should never lose sight of the fact. Everything in it was designed to remind the children of Israel at every moment and at every turn that they were God's elect. Thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God, and the Lord hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself, above all the nations that are upon the earth. To bring that momentous fact home to Israel was the fundamental purpose of the law. We found all the topics which ye have so far studied to have been merely different means to that one end. Each in its own peculiar and distinctive way served to quicken the nation's consciousness of its high rank and destiny, and each in pursuit of that aim made use of the same effective teaching technique, that of restating one simple basic lesson in a sequence of increasingly more emphatic forms. This, as we shall now proceed to see, was as true of Israel's calendar as of every other element of the law. In Israel's calendar, as in every other, the day was the standard unit of time. So to it, the law assigned the task of teaching Israel its one essential lesson. Some days were declared to be of more than ordinary sanctity, and certain of them were grouped together into periods of special importance and significance, but quite apart from the ulterior didactic purpose which these unusual arrangements served, they all equally contrived to present that one fundamental lesson in heightened and intensified form. To teach that lesson in its simplest form was the function of the daily offerings. These were the daily provision of two lambs of burnt offering, plus meal and drink offering, for the altar of burnt offering, of oil for the lampstand, and of incense for the incense altar. The significance of these offerings we have already summarily examined in connection with the ritual of the sanctuary, but it bears repetition in this new context, especially now that the role and meaning of the altar offerings have become familiar to us. The two lambs burnt daily upon the altar, with never the exception of a single day, one in the morning to begin the day's round of sacrifice and another in the evening to end it, were in every sense of the term a continual burnt offering. However special or however outstanding certain days were declared to be, the sacrifices peculiar to those days were always offered in addition to the daily burnt offering, never in lieu of it. The rule for these sacrifices was always that they should be offered beside the continual burnt offering. That was to be the one constant, indispensable offering which God required of his people, in intimation of that constancy and fidelity of service which he expected of them axiomatically. This continual offering, being a burnt offering, signified that the nation, conscious of having received atonement for its sin, wished to devote itself and its labours, these being symbolised by the meal and drink offering, utterly to God. Not a day was to pass without such a ritual confession by the nation in this representative way of the character of its fundamental duty as God's covenant people. The fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. It shall never go out. was the rule for the day, and likewise also for the night. It is the burnt offering because of the burning upon the altar all night unto the morning. By this symbolic means, each day was shown to be ideally not something separate and distinct in itself, but only one brief stage in a continuous process of spiritual activity before God and of service to Him. The double nature of the offering served to emphasize that lesson for each individual in the nation by showing him that his life was meant to begin and end in God, who had delivered him from sin's bondage. The evening oblation, inasmuch as it came at the close of the day, spoke symbolically of a day's work done, and so, by extension, of a whole life lived as to God, of a duty accomplished, of an ideal attained. As such, it was to some extent more significant allegorically than that of the morning, which may explain why the psalmist besought God, "Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice." Apart from this distinction, however, the evening and morning oblation both served the same essential purpose and spoke equally of constancy in self-devotion and in service to God. So, in its special way, did the burning of the oil in the lightstand, yielding light to dispel the darkness and thus serving as a symbol of Israel's bright witness for God in the darkness of heathendom around. The symbolism emphasized the national character of that witness. "Thou shalt command the children of Israel that they bring thee pure oil, olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always." Inferior oil would have meant a feeble flame, and even entailed the risk that the light would flicker and go out completely. So the oil had to be the best. Pure oil, olive, beaten. Since nothing short of the best would do for God, or ensure a bright and constant flame. The lamps had to be tended at the beginning and end of each day. This was done in conjunction with the priestly duty of burning sweet incense on the incense altar, the coals used for the purpose being doubtless taken from the fire beneath the lamb of burnt offering as it burnt upon the altar in the court. Like continual burnt offering, the incense was a perpetual incense before the Lord. Both were, in fact, parallel types, each signifying a constancy of worship toward God, day by day, continually, as a token of Israel's acknowledgement of its duty as the priestly people. Each day was thus an epitome of the entire year, and its standard ritual a permanent object lesson and reminder to Israel of the obligations of its standing before God. The lamb of daily offering being a particularly clear reminder of the lamb of Passover, which delivered the firstborn from death. As with every other subject, in order to understand the calendar, we need first to know it, to appreciate the significance of its special days and festivals and the ritual peculiar to them. We must first of all familiarize ourselves with the facts regarding each of them. For this purpose, we shall adopt the following reference table. 1. The Sabbath. to A, Passover, to B, first fruits, 3, weeks, 4, new moons, 5, Day of Atonement, and 6, tabernacles. Sabbath. The lessons of the daily offerings were fundamental, and each day's routine ritual bore unfailing witness to them, but they needed repeated reiteration in a resting form. The law made this possible by its special days and festal periods. The first of these, in fact, the prototype of all the others, was the Sabbath. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily my Sabbaths ye shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am the Lord that doth sanctify you. We note the nature of the sign. It brought home to Israel that it was God who had made them what they were. I am the Lord that doth sanctify you. Neglect to observe the Sabbath amounted, therefore, to contempt of his saving work on their behalf, and a willful disregard of the reason for it, namely that they should be holy to him. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy unto you, to act as though the day was not holy to them, would be to do despite to their calling. It would be equivalent to a repudiation both of the privilege of membership of the covenant people and of the unparalleled responsibility which went with it. So the law was uncompromising. As men treated God, so he would treat them. Everyone that defileth it shall be put to death. That is, those who by their attitude and actions treated their covenant status as of little worth would forfeit it by death. For whosoever doeth any work therein, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. The day was of such outstanding importance because it so concisely symbolized both the character and the ultimate end of God's purpose with Israel. It bore expressive witness as the Sabbath of rest, that he had redeemed them with the aim of giving them rest from sin's bondage, repose after the toil of mortality. He who had done this for them, who thus showed them special favor and associated his name with theirs, was none other than the eternal Creator, the sovereign Lord of the entire universe, who himself in 6 days made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day rested and was refreshed. But by one man sin had entered into the world, serving both to disturb God's rest and to bring man into subjection to its evil power. Forthwith God had set in operation his redeeming purpose, working anew in order to deliver man from his helpless bondage to sin, and thereby restore that rest which sin had so rudely and tragically broken. So God's work with Israel was an expressive guarantee of the eventual triumphant consummation of that purpose, and as such a sign of the most momentous import. Contempt for the sign was thus equivalent to contempt for the purpose of universal redemption to which it bore witness, and for the privileges which Israel enjoyed as the firstborn nation. And for that reason, the attitude of the man who died for willful refusal to honor the Sabbath was basically the same as that of all those who failed to enter the rest of Canaan when they were bidden to go in, and who, in consequence of disobedience, were debarred from entering, God swearing to them in his wrath that they should not enter into his rest. The Sabbath, therefore, was preeminently Israel's day. Remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. The Sabbath was, very appropriately, the day appointed for the renewal of the loaves upon the table of showbread. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. What the daily burnt offering taught daily, the bread upon the table taught weekly. As the one was the continual burnt offering, so the other was the continual bread. Continual, because the table was never to be clear of the bread. Not even when being transported from place to place as the camp moved forward. That is, though the Sabbath, because it occurred only once in 7 days, was a periodical event only, it nevertheless symbolized the spiritual state which was meant to characterize Israel continually and permanently. As the normal day was the basic unit of the calendar in general, this special day was likewise the basic unit of the festal calendar in particular. It was the first of those special days called Holy Convocations, and indeed the epitome of them all. The seventh day is the Sabbath of rest and Holy Convocation. If only Israel could rise to its true destiny, not only one day in seven, but every day would be likewise holy. It was for this reason that the sacrificial ritual of the Sabbath duplicated that of every normal day. The rule was on the Sabbath day, two lambs of the first year without spot, with the same meal and drink offering as for the daily burnt offering. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath. Beside the continual burnt offering and his drink offering, thus each Sabbath was likewise but the epitome of the entire year. In its standard ritual, a permanent object lesson, a reminder to Israel of the obligations of its standing as a holy nation before God. Upon it, the people were to assemble. That would seem to be the implication of holy convocation. To remind themselves and each other of God's doings and purposes with them. It's meant to be a joyous day to them, commemorative of their joy when they sang the song of Moses after the crossing of the Red Sea, chanting, "Thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation." Like that song, it took account of both the present and the future, of the rest of today, and of that rest which is to come, compressing into itself the lessons of both the holy and most holy. But this it did only for those who accounted it a delight, the holy of the Lord, honourable, and who by their observance of it were constrained to rest from their own sinful works in order the better to serve God in true holiness. First day, then week, then month. That is the natural order of progression. It is also the one followed by the sacrificial schedule of Numbers 28. There were, however, two very important mid-month festivals, Passover and Tabernacles. And as the first of these fell in the first month, Abib, we will follow the chronological order of the calendar as we have it in Leviticus 23, postponing our examination of the monthly ritual until we reach the seventh month of the sacred year. Passover, as first observed in Egypt, spoke to Israel, as we have seen, of redemption through sacrifice and of rest from bondage to sin. So vital was its ritual meaning to Israel as God's people that God designated it my sacrifice. The slaying of the firstborn began after sundown, midway through Abib. Before sundown, the Israelites had had to slay the lamb to procure its blood to serve as a token and a sign. So the rule became, in the 14th day of the first month, at even is the Lord's Passover. But that terrible first night in Egypt, though spelling disaster to Egypt, meant release from bondage to Israel. Even the selfsame day it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It's a night to be much observed unto the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. This day, particularly as it could so conveniently serve as an anniversary of the original event, was therefore even better qualified than the Sabbath to act as a commemoration of the Exodus. Hence the law, on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread unto the Lord. That feast was intended to bring home to Israel with urgent force the moral demands of their status as God's ransomed people. So the rule was, 7 days ye must eat unleavened bread. Of these, the first, that is, Abib the 15th, was an holy convocation, and thus an extra Sabbath. All servile work was forbidden, the epithet servile suggesting that commemoration of their serfdom in Egypt. Was the idea intended to be uppermost in their mind, and that abstinence from work in general was not to be so stringent as on an ordinary Sabbath, when even the busy activity of sowing and harvest had to be interrupted. But though the servile work was prohibited, from one form of activity they could not rest. Ye shall do no servile work therein, but ye shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days. The duration of the feast, 7 days, was itself of sabbatical import and appropriate as a period during which the covenant people should commemorate its deliverance. As the week began, so it ended. In the seventh day, it is an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. The schedule of altar offerings for each of the 7 days was significant. It was, one, a burnt offering of 2 young bullocks, 1 ram, and 7 lambs of the first year. 2, a meal offering, as specified for each animal in the schedule of Numbers 15. And thirdly, a sin offering of just 1 goat. After this manner, you shall offer daily throughout the 7 days the meat of the sacrifice made by fire of a sweet savour unto the Lord, shall be offered beside the continual burnt offering and his drink offering. Thus, while the nation abstained from leaven, that is, ritually abstained from sinning, in recognition of the obligations of its calling, it simultaneously pledged itself entirely to God by sacrificing to him of the flock and of the herd, a series of animal offerings, all without blemish. Among them, seven lambs. Seven to represent the people. Lambs to recall the Passover victim in the same way as the daily burnt offering. But in recognition of its actual sinfulness, which so belied the meaning of the ritual as a whole. Each day there was offered as well a goat of sin offering. This would of course be offered before the special burnt offerings and was a single animal, because sin offering was never anything but a single animal. But both the multiplicity and the greatly superior value of the burnt offerings ensured for the idea of self-consecration the special prominence which it was meant to have in the thoughts of the people at this time. The additional meal offering spoke likewise of righteous works, in significant contrast to the unrighteous works to which the presentation of the goat unhappily bore witness. We've seen how the permanent legislation for the observance of Passover commemorated the redemption of Israel from Egyptian bondage and reiterated the moral demands implicit in that momentous event. Thus far, however, we have met no allusion in the ritual to the deliverance of the firstborn as such. This is because that deliverance was to be commemorated in a special way, a way which was more effective than sacrifice on its own, as a means of teaching Israel that it was actually only the first of a multitude of nations to receive the salvation of God. Immediately after mentioning Passover, the festal calendar of Leviticus 23 continues. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye be come into the land which I give you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then ye shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priests. The juxtaposition of the two ordinances, that of Passover and that of the presentation of the sheaf, is significant enough to begin with, but it is doubly so when we observe the sheaf to have been a sheaf of the first fruits of harvest. The law clearly intended to indicate a parallel between the presentation of the firstborn and that of the first fruits. The presentation of both was made to the priest, he being a type of God. For to Aaron God said, Whatsoever is first ripe in the land which they shall bring unto the Lord shall be thine. Everything that openeth the matrix and all flesh which they bring unto the Lord, whether it be of men or beasts, shall be thine. And this same close connection between the firstborn and the first fruits is implicit in the Book of the Covenant and also elsewhere. The sacred calendar thus enlisted the facts of harvest as teaching aids and adapted them as means of reminding Israel of the grand sweep of God's purpose. The first fruits were but precursors of more to come, the initial instalment of a greater harvest to follow. In presenting the first sheaf of grain harvest, Israel thus gave ritual assent to the fact the multitude of others would be reaped besides. Once more, the literal and the material served as the sign and symbol of the spiritual. And not of the spiritual only, but also of the moral. For the sheaf had to be waved before the Lord, that is, consecrated to him. At one and the same time, Israel acknowledged that it depended for life itself upon God, the provider of the bounty of harvest, and also pledged its life and service to him in return. The sheaf, therefore, represented the nation and also its works. since it was the first result of their toil in the field, and symbolized Israel's readiness to honor its holy calling as the firstborn nation. The sheaf had to be presented on the morrow after the Sabbath. It is not indicated whether this was the normal Sabbath, Abib 14, or the first of the year's seven holy convocations, Abib 15. While for that reason we cannot dogmatize in view of the fact that Abib 15 began a new week and thus constituted a fresh start, there would be a distinct fitness in the presentation of the sheaf upon that day rather than upon Abib 16. And the fact that it was declared a Sabbath, plus the fact that it was in that capacity the first of a series of seven such special Sabbaths, would seem to put our conclusion beyond all doubt. The ritual spoke expressively of a new beginning, a new era, which brought freedom from sin's thraldom. At all events, as now we would expect, the connection of the ceremony with Passover was decidedly close in time as well as in ritual significance. This makes it as certain as it is possible to be that the sheaf was of barley, since Passover came too early for wheat to be yet ripe enough to cut. This would be appropriate since it signified the commencement of the grain harvest as a whole, even though it was a relatively inferior grain. And though only a single sheaf, it still served as a symbol of an entire harvest, since within its unity as a sheaf, it comprehended a multiplicity of seeds. In every way, the first fruit stood for the whole. Israel's firstborn had typified the entire nation on the fateful night of Passover. And so now, Israel stood as the firstborn nation for all other nations who would ultimately be gathered in to complete the divine harvest of redemption. When all this has been said, however, it must be stressed that the offering was vegetable and so bloodless, therefore needed to be accompanied by, and was almost certainly preceded by, an animal offering. This again was reminiscent of Passover, being an he-lamb without blemish of the first year. It was offered as a burnt offering. Appreciation of God's goodness as Lord of the harvest being expressed in a meal offering twice the normal size. The drink offering, however, remained the standard fourth part of the hin, since the ceremony bore no allusion to the vintage. Not until the ceremony had been properly observed had Israel the right to use any of the harvesters' food, the moral being that not until the nation had totally consecrated itself to God would it enjoy the right to live before him as his people in the fullest sense.